You know who this is. Welcome to the Pure Individual Podcast. In 2017, I learned of the genocide that was being carried out against the Yazidi people by the so-called Islamic State, also known as ISIS, or what we like to call Daesh. I was shocked. I was shocked that women and children were just rounded up and violated and sold, trafficked, and men were slaughtered, all because they believed something different, and because they were seen as inferior. I was enraged. I started to research and investigate the conflict in northern Iraq and northern Syria. And I became educated in the Kurdish Liberation Movement. The movement is a two-part movement. First, it's a political solution. And if the political solution fails, then arms have to be taken up. The Kurdish people have been fighting for a very long time. And in that moment, in 2018, they had done magnificent work in pushing back the so-called Islamic State and regaining territory in their ancestral homeland, Rojava, Western Kurdistan. I applied to join the Kurdish militias. It's an all-volunteer force. And they don't take many Westerners. Not for fighting anyways. I applied and I waited. I was so enraged that this was happening in my world. It was something that I could not allow to exist. I cannot allow genocide to exist in my world. It's not something that I'm okay with, and it's extremely personal for me, being of the Acholi tribe in Eastern Africa. My tribe had its own civil war genocide that happened, so it's an atrocity and a crime that's very near to me. And it invokes an extreme amount of passion. A passion that I have very little places to put it to. Eventually I was accepted. And I went to Kurdistan. And I lived among the Kurdish people. And it took time for me to learn Kurdish. I couldn't learn it through reading it. It was not something that I fully understood at the time, but my rightness wasn't going to be compatible with learning Kurdish in a strategic way. So I learned it through immersion, through being around it, and one day I was speaking Kurdish. And they are the best people in the world. I say that because they care, and they care enough. They care enough to fight. They care enough to die. They care enough to live for what they believe to be right and what they believe to be just, and for the preservation of their culture and their identity, which has been under attack ever since colonial powers carved up Kurdistan, carved up the Middle East. Kurdistan is occupied by the Neo-Ottomans of Turkey. It is occupied by the Syrian state. It is occupied by the Iraqi state. It is occupied by the Iranian state. And this isn't common knowledge. It's all suppressed. And they continue to fight. And they continue to set up regions and zones and areas where they can speak their language, because these nation states have forbidden their language. That is a form of genocide, identity erasure. Not only that, but they have, for decades, enforced them to assimilate, to no longer be Kurdish, and they've resisted. And they've continued to resist. And that's the soft part of the war. That's the soft part of the genocide. Kurds have been killed for speaking Kurdish. Kurds have been killed for identifying as Kurdish. When the Kurdish people adopted me, that's a moment in my life that I don't have words for. After some time, I was no longer seen as American. They had a joke in my unit that I was half African and half Kurdish. And they wouldn't let anybody call me American. They would make sure that everybody knew that I was either fully Kurdish or half Kurdish and half African. It wasn't the same for the rest of the Westerners on my team. And that honor has always stuck with me. And it's going to stick with me if I had a pistol to my head and somebody asked me to deny whether or not I'm Kurdish. They'd have to pull the trigger. That's something I'll never deny. It's too important to me. It's too important to them. now I'm in a place in my process where my life has changed a lot. I have a different calling that I know is a lifetime calling and a lifetime responsibility. And some of the people who love me the most and that I love the most have been fighting since I came home. It never stopped for them. When the Islamic State was defeated territorially, of course, there was somewhat of a period of less fighting. But even then, their ideology is too deep, and frankly, as an organization, they're intelligent. So defeating them territorially, it's not enough to stop them. They have an ideology that has been deeply ingrained in the areas where they brainwashed children and teens, and it's going to take decades for that ideology to be cut out. When I saw that the regime had fallen, the first instinct that I had was to see who took Damascus. And who took Damascus is based off history. Not a liberator. They're not liberators. I can't speak to what their intentions are now, but I can say that these many rebel groups that are jihadists with Salafist ideology, are largely tied to some major organizations. And at the end of the day, what they want is control over everything. When the Islamic State was around territorially, they would go in and they would liberate a village or a city from whoever was governing, and the people would think that it was great that they were being liberated. And ISIS, they would portray that they were there as liberators, and then, you know, a week later, hands are getting chopped off and people are getting decapitated. And their laws are being enforced, and women are disappearing, and children are disappearing. I don't know if that's what's going to happen in Damascus, but they're cut from a similar cloth. Really, they're the antithesis. Of the Kurdish freedom movement. So many Kurds and so many of my comrades are Sunni Muslims. And they're a light that's in the darkness that is fighting a darkness that's incomprehensible to Western civilization. Yeah. We didn't fight for power. We still don't fight for power. It's about liberation. It's so that it's not illegal to speak the Kurdish language. It's so it's not illegal to identify as a Kurd, so that it's not illegal to practice Kurdish traditions. Because in these occupying countries, it's illegal in many ways. And if it's not illegal socially, it's suppressed. And it's not just in these four nation states that occupy Kurdistan. It also happens in Europe. The only place in the world where the political system requires 40% representation be women is in the autonomous region of northern Syria, the autonomous region, also known in Kurmanji as Rojava, is everything, because it is a place where direct democracy has been established, where our true representation has been established for every sex, every ethnicity, every belief system, and everybody lives and works together. And yet, it's constantly bombarded by the Neo-Ottoman Empire. It is constantly bombed, shelled. There's attacks from their proxies. I'm taking things day by day. All I can do from here is spread awareness of my experience, contribute awareness of my experience. And that's very difficult for me because I am a man that, although words are weapons, and I am very effective at using words, and I'm very much designed to use words to mutate and bring change into this world, I am also inclined to pick up a rifle and go to work. And that is not something that I can do. And I feel quite powerless. It's not that I'm not aware of the difference that can be made with awareness. It's because I'm aware of that difference that I'm also aware of the difference that can be made through armed struggle. Both are important. Northeastern Syria, the autonomous region that is Kurdish-led, is the only place in that area where you can wear what you want, you can listen to the music that you want, you can vote. Women can vote. Women hold 40% of all political power. There's not even a president. There's a co-presidency requires a man and a woman. I was trained by and educated by some of the most remarkable, fierce, feminine, pure women to ever walk this earth. And they taught me extensively about women's history, the women's history that we don't get taught here in the West. They taught me extensively what it meant to them to be a woman and what it meant to them to be seen in their power. I saw it. I felt it. I was around it. And it is so different from the West. So different. They made me a better man. It made me a better man because they reinforced that the world needs men. And the world needs strong men. The world needs men that are capable of protecting by any means necessary. Something that's heavily frowned upon in the West or held with contempt. But in the East, it's a reality. And for the Kurds, it's a reality. Kurdish women can operate rifles. Kurdish women that are in the women's protection units or any of the different women's units, there's many. They are among the most effective anti-terror forces that the world has ever seen. We are, the men's units and the women's units, more effective than any military has ever been. And we don't do it for money. It's all volunteer force. We do it because there are some things in this world that do not deserve to exist. And that line is crossed at genocide and human trafficking for me. That line is crossed for others in their own uniqueness according to their own beliefs. And that's one of the things that I found so beautiful about Kurdish culture that I continue to find beautiful about Kurdish culture is that we all had our own beliefs. We all had our own ideologies. We all had our own ways of seeing things. The one thing that we all held in common was that jihadism, fascism, oppression needs to be destroyed. And historically speaking, the only way that it's destroyed is through armed struggle, armed resistance. And so those of us that can act in that capacity do. I was gifted. I have a gift for destroying. I have a gift for combat. I can't sit idle and allow a gift that was given to me to go to waste. So when it's necessary, I'm going to honor that gift. Right now, the situation has changed massively in Syria. When the regime was around, there was a counterbalance. We had the north and the regime had the south. The north is Western Kurdistan and the south is Syria. We didn't want to have anything to do with that. We didn't need to have anything to do with that because that's not ancestrally Kurdish land. Although Rojava is still part of Syria, they still fly the Syrian flag there. That is still very much part of the identity of those that are born in Syria. But when the regime was around, there was a counterbalance because there was multiple players that were at work there. Syrian Democratic Forces, which is my people, the various militias that make up the Syrian Democratic Forces. And then there was the Iranian militias, the various jihadist organizations and gangs. The Turkish military presence, Russian military presence. There was a lot of players. I can't get into all of those details. The situation has changed now with the regime out, because with the regime out, it also pulls any sort of interference that was coming from the East and Russia or Iran. It pulls their interests away. So now, the most prosperous, free, self-governed area in the entire Middle East is being converged on by all the jihadist organizations that are there, and including the ones that were put away, being let out outside of prison. And it appears as though Endymion they'll all be under the same banner, converging on my people, under the Kurdish people. And as daunting as that sounds, I'm also aware of how capable my people are. Rarely in human history has there ever been self-determination that comes anywhere close to Kurdish self-determination. It's going to be a difficult... It's going to be a difficult fight. And a lot of lives are going to pay the price. But they're going to resist. They always resist. They always resist. It's what we do. No matter how outnumbered we are. I can't give specifics, but I've been outnumbered by 50,000. Been outnumbered by nation states, and with all the odds against us, and we would drink some black tea with sugar, because that's all we'd really drink. Smoke some cigarettes, make some jokes. Hope that if it's our time, when we get our ticket punched, it's a good death. Don't want a bad death. No warrior wants a bad death. We don't break morale. And I'm not going to lose my morale. Even though every day I can feel my heart bending more and more. And there'll be a day that I feel my heart break. But I'll never lose my morale. If there's one thing that my people would ask of me, if there's one thing that my comrades who fell in battle would ask of me, it's to keep my morale. So I'm going to keep my morale. No matter how hard it can be to be so far away from a place and beings that I shed blood for, that I would gladly lay my life down for. The least I can do is keep my morale. And continue to live my life in such a way that I retain my honor. And so that is what I'm going to do. This is part one. I hope you all enjoyed that. Bye for now.